I suppose my department could infect him, some rapidly terminal disease. Would his natural death help?
I don't think so.
What we need is something to discredit him.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, the old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. From gold-backed dollar to petrodollar to narco-dollar, the decline, the criminalisation of the American currency. But it doesn't even get a mention as London hosts the world's so-called anti-corruption conference. Meanwhile, Brazil's President Dilma Rousseff is elected on an anti-corruption ticket. She's been ousted by the corrupt old guard just before the Olympic Games. So will Brazil return to military dictatorship? Or is the CIA and its US meddling in South America going to be more subtle this time? Also, NATO's political lobby, 4 weeks to the Bilderberg Conference in Dresden and 6 weeks to the EU referendum. This week we find out Angela Merkel and her top six ministers, the apex of the German government, will all be there. And it's not a political meeting, just informal discussions, no press allowed and no questions asked. Pull the other one. Also, murder charges for British personnel involved in lethal drone strikes. That's the warning from a parliamentary committee this week. As well as new revelations about the extent to which our taxpayers' money is going to fund the Syrian rebels. PR. Yes, you and I are paying a terrorist propaganda machine. You couldn't make it up. Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. Our sister show Dialect is back at noon every Tuesday. Next week we hear all about the NABCA week and the Brexit vote from the Palestine Museum in Broad Street, as well as Britain's first black broadcaster Alex Pascal talks about London electing Europe's first Muslim mayor. Next Saturday, a talk in Salford about railway history and HS2 from one of Britain's unsung experts. He's entertaining and he's encyclopedic, the journalist Chris Hewitt. That's all on Dialect next Tuesday at noon. Martin, I think we should start this week, really, by looking at this bomb attack in Baghdad. It's almost as if these things happen and nobody notices. 90 people killed in Baghdad, mainly in Sadr City this week.
Well, it's been going on relentlessly there ever since the West invaded in 2003. You can imagine what people are feeling now after weeks, months, years of this kind of mess being inflicted on them. Appalling.
I mean, we were talking, weren't we, in the first hour with Thangam about the whole debacle at the BBC with the government intervention, the sacking of the Director General, the sacking also the journalist that talked about the dossier being sexed up, Andrew Gilligan. I mean, this is really a massive crime that Britain's been involved in here, and of course Tony Blair is still walking the streets.
He is, and of course the Chilcot report is finally going to come out of the bowels of Westminster eventually in the next few weeks.
Well, it's going to be just after the Brexit vote.
Yeah, well, I mean, the fact is I don't, these kind of inquiries, I don't expect them to be true to what's really going on. I mean, we know that the war was actually cooked up by the US
Salmond,
and the Israelis.
Martin.
I mean, and most of the excuses for it were simply excuses.
Alex Salmond from the SNP says Blair should be impeached over it.
Well, I think that's possibly right. You see, we could get into a situation where we're going to have an internal struggle in the Labour Party, and it could be that instead of Ken Livingstone being suspended from the Labour Party, it could be Tony Blair who's suspended. And
Salmond is not just talking about suspension from the Labour Party.
No, he should. Obviously, if all those involved should in fact face war crimes trials, because they knowingly misled the British public in order to start a war, which not only they did not win, they have now created further wars. It's like smashing a billiard ball into the Middle East, and we're still living with the consequences decades later.
Okay, so
and millions are displaced, hundreds of thousands are dead. The consequences have been absolutely horrendous, and of course everybody thinks that they can all just go in for a nice cup of tea now, but I'm afraid we can't.
Well, Alex Salmond said, not on the BBC, but on Russia Today, was, I believe that Prime Minister Blair recommitted himself to war pre-committed himself to war in the Crawford Ranch at some point. There was a pre-commitment that he would go with George Bush into Iraq, come what may. Now, that, obviously, is a war crime, an illegal. I mean, the casualties in Iraq also have been horrendous, and, of course, this has also led to the creation of ISIS. What's your take on how this has all played out over the last decade, or it's 12, 13 years now?
Well,
isn't it? 14
in
years?
Sadr City itself, where these bombs went off, which is a stronghold of support for Muqtada al-Sadr, because it was named after his father.
Yeah, Muqtada al-Sadr, yeah.
Yeah, it was named after his father, who was a big opponent of Saddam Hussein. They believe that ISIS is being armed, trained and supported by the Gulf Cooperation Council and NATO. And you know what? The people in Sadr City are probably right. So the idea that ISIS is in fact a cat's paw. You see, what ISIS does, and with its relative success in the northern part of Iraq, is it gives an excuse for the Americans to remain in Iraq to deal with ISIS. Although there's tremendous suspicion of American motives on behalf of the Shiites
I'll tell you one thing about Baghdad, is that if you want to get people out on the streets and excited about something, they're not interested in what the government parties have got to say there. They're much more interested in what Muqtada al-Sadr and the Shia clerics are saying. They can bring almost the entire population out on the streets. So it seems that the clerics have got more support than the politicians. Isn't this just a Western kind of model being imposed on a country that's just not ready
I think that what the West is doing is intervening in the internal politics of Iraq to try and steer it in a direction it wants to go in. Iraq's natural orientation would be aligned with a democratic Iran, with a democratic Iraq, and that's always what was going to happen, because that's the natural.
But they're run by mullahs; they're not run by elected politicians.
No, but don't forget,
Muqtada
al-Sadr, his actual clerical credentials are relatively weak. He's basically a religious politician, which is not that uncommon in history.
Yeah, but you get them in Iran too, don't you?
You get them all over the world.
But that's surely more of the model for that.
Well, I mean, you have
world.
Christian Democrats in Germany who are openly Catholic, and that's what defines their politics, and they are Democrats on top of that. What's wrong with people? I'm not religious. I don't define my politics religiously.
Tony Blair was apparently
indeed.
Sort of, and George Bush. So
there's no rule that says you can't be have religious views and be involved in politics.
This is used as a kind of cloak, isn't it, by some politicians?
But basically, they've messed up Iraq in order to. There's all sorts of reasons why they did it, and nothing to do with weapons of mass destruction, by the way, as we all know. And of course, all they've managed to do is to reduce the country to absolute misery. And ultimately, they'll have to sort out their own problems. We can't sort them out for them. And the idea, I mean, basically, Muqtada al-Sadr does not want American help to fight ISIS.
What you're saying is we've virtually destroyed their country, but it's their problem.
No, we can help.
You
but
can
not
say the
by,
same
not,
for the
not
Palestinians,
through, not through
you,
military, not through military intervention
in NABCA week. You can say the same for the Palestinians. Well, we're very sorry we left Palestine in such a mess, but you're going to have to sort it out yourself.
If you remember, Obama agreed to withdraw all U.S. forces from Iraq, or rather, was forced to do so because the Iraqi government insisted that they would have to abide by Iraqi law. In other words, if they killed civilians or did nasty stuff, they would have to stand trial inside Iraq, and that was al-Sistani who pushed for that, who's another very important figure, more moderate than Muqtada al-Sadr and more religious, more like an Archbishop of Canterbury type figure. He was the one who forced an election on Paul Bremer and the occupation authorities because they just basically wanted to run the place like a corporation. And al-Sistani said, no, we're not having that. We want an election. But of course, elections don't always bring people together. They show up the divisions. But Al-Sadr in the past has actually tried to build bridges with the Sunni community. So he's not a sectarian in the way that he's presented in the Western media. So, for example, when Fallujah was under attack by American forces supported by the British Black Watch, Al-Sadr was trying to, get people into, medical supplies and other things in to help the people fighting the occupation authorities. His line is nationalistic. He's actually not that pro-Iranian, Al-Sadr.
Okay.
He's an Iraqi nationalist.
Okay, so let's have a bit of a wider look around the Middle East. Of course, Syria is borders with Iraq, and today we've heard that the Hezbollah leader in Syria has been killed. Can you just explain to us Hezbollah, how do they fit into all of this, and ISIS, how do they fit into the conflict that's going on there with ISIS, the al-Nusra Front, and the, well, so-called rebels, the Free Syrian Army, if they still exist?
I mean, this guy was a senior Hezbollah commander, so he's from the military wing of Hezbollah rather than the political wing like Nasrullah.
He's talked of as a terrorist, obviously, by
these people are all terrorists. Of course, the rebels we support in Syria are freedom fighters and rebels, but Hezbollah are terrorists, because that's the Israeli definition of who's a terrorist and who isn't. In any case, killing somebody like this with no trial of any kind, that is a terrorist act by the Israelis. Well, forget they've got no jurisdiction
in Syria. If he's Hezbollah war commander, he may just die in battle, mightn't he?
Well, he may, but the Israelis have got no jurisdiction inside Syria. None at all. They're not allowed to go around just killing people because they don't like them in other foreign countries where they have no jurisdiction. I'm actually surprised that we're able to do it. That's very interesting.
Well, this is drones, and we're going to be coming on
to
that.
Well, it was a drone, but don't forget, you've got Russian and Syrian air defence now in Syria, which is pretty robust. They ought to have been able to take out that Israeli drone or Israeli aircraft that carried out the attack. But we still don't know exactly how it was done.
Looking at Libya, because of course a lot of the fighters are from Libya, the ones that are in Syria now. Apparently the US has now got what sound like permanent military bases in Libya.
Well, this is what this is all about. What you do is you invade, destabilise, destroy those who are opposed to your general geopolitical plans, and then in the ensuing chaos you can insert yourself. What the US wants is military bases around the world from which to project power. So they want to keep bases in Afghanistan. They want to keep bases in Iraq. They want to, they're trying to establish bases in Syria, even though they've got no business there at all. The purpose of having the bases is not to stabilise that. You see, American bases are pretty heavily defended. Hezbollah, in fact, were the only people who ever really penetrated a US base when they blew up the US Marine compound in Beirut in 1983 and killed 250-odd US Marines. They did it with suicide bombers. Hezbollah are very militarily effective, but also because they're very politically dedicated. They have taken the brunt of various Israeli incursions into Lebanon. They are part of the Lebanese political structure. I don't think they've actually got a government in Lebanon at the moment, but Hezbollah have been part of the governing parties, the governing coalitions in Lebanon in the past. So they're perfectly legitimate political actors.
Yemen is another place where drones have been being used over the last 7-8 years or so, mostly by the US. We hear in today 13 Yemeni troops have been killed in ISIS attacks on a naval base. So ISIS is now getting very active over in Yemen too. It's a war that we almost don't hear about anymore. In fact, it's not really fair to call it a war, because most of the deaths in Yemen have been of civilians, and they've mostly been being caused by Saudi Arabian airstrikes, which are using often our jets and our munitions. I say British jets and British munitions.
Well, what is a war, Tony? I mean, Oxfam pointed this out years ago. Since 1945, over 80% plus of casualties in all wars are civilian. That's our wars and their wars, terrorist wars, any kind of war you care to define.
Well, they talk about war not happening in Europe, but European countries have certainly been involved in wars outside.
Well, they have. They have indeed.
Particularly Britain.
And of course, you know, this all comes back to bite you when you get incidents like in Brussels, but that's not blowback. You've got to realise that the Russian general staff and the Iranian general staff and Hezbollah's intelligence operation, they know what they know. And what they know is that Mossad, CIA, MI6 and the Saudi secret services are behind ISIS, al-Nusra Front, etc. So I don't think there's any doubt in their minds about that. Whatever Western public opinion does or does not know, they know what they're doing. They realise what they're up against. If you listen to what the Iranians are saying, they make it pretty clear what their views are.
What's behind this war in Yemen then? Because it's been going on for over a year now. Tens of thousands of civilians killed. I remember being absolutely gobsmacked that it hardly even made the news that 130 people had been killed, civilians in a market, by a Saudi airstrike back in January, February.
Well, you know, I read a very interesting article about this on New Eastern Outlook, which is a very good online magazine. Do you know what? There's a plan to build a canal to cut off the Strait of Hormuz. The Strait of Hormuz seals the Gulf. And therefore, the Saudis have to take their oil out through the Strait of Hormuz, which the Iranians can seal at any time. But if they could capture Yemen, they could build a canal, and apparently this canal has already been prospected for, and then their ships could sail, the oil tankers could sail through this canal and into the Indian Ocean without crossing, going around the Straits of Hormuz, which would then prevent the Iranians having a stranglehold over the Saudis' oil exports. But of course, don't forget that the Saudi oil industry is concentrated in the east of the country, and most of the oil workers are in fact Shia, and they could in fact set up an independent state there with their Bahraini colleagues, and they could have that oil industry.
I'm really puzzled with the geography here, Goat, because Yemen is at the bottom left, isn't it, of the the Arabian Peninsula. And the only pinch point there, naval-wise, is the Bab al-Mandeb Strait, which is kind of the opposite side of the peninsula.
Yeah, but they're trying to capture the other end of Yemen so that they could then build a canal. I only read this recently.
Okay.
It struck me as odd, but the people who were writing it were serious, and they were saying that is part... And don't forget, Saudi Arabia, is under its current regime, is just reckless. They're just reckless, and there's a general desire anyway to get this over with and have a proper old war with Iran.
It does show you, though, doesn't it, that wars like this can happen, and there's no intervention, it seems, at all from the United Nations.
Well, the United Nations just hovers around. There's been intervention from the United States and Britain. Our military personnel are supporting the aggressors.
There isn't. I mean, it's the United
Nations.
I'm
not a pacifist. Maybe somebody should put a bullet through their head. What do you think?
Has the United Nations come to the end of its useful life? Because it does seem that the only recent conflict, which is the Syrian conflict, which has been, there's been any kind of intervention to stop the regime change, stop the stabilisation, to try and stabilise the country, is because the superpower Russia has gotten involved, and that's only because they've got bases in Syria.
Well, the Russian position would be that we've got to get back to abiding by Westphalian international law. And what I mean by Westphalian international law is the whole basis of the international system: sovereignty of states, equality of representation, everybody's views to count. And the Russians are very wisely, insofar as they are fighting for that principle.
So has the United Nations already gone the way of the League of Nations?
No, the Russians would argue opposite. They would say, look, it doesn't fulfil its functions properly. It's been corrupted by various powerful forces in the West. The Israelis, for example, are scofflaws in relation to the UN and all the rest of it. But that doesn't mean we should throw out the baby with the bathwater. The UN structure is the only thing we've got between us and totally barbaric head-to-head confrontation. And I would be damn fools to throw that away, even when it's being manipulated. We're still rowing within that structure, and that's the way it should continue to be. The League of Nations, of course, big countries like the US, who wouldn't join it, and Italy and Germany and Japan, who walked away from it, the United Nations still has the majority of the world's states represented in it, including states that are hostile to each other. There's a question mark over whether the state of Israel should have a seat. You know, this whole question of whether people should or shouldn't be recognised is definitely there to be discussed. Kosovo still doesn't have a seat, not just because it's not been recognised by the Russians and the Serbs, but because it hasn't been recognised by the Spanish. or by the, I don't know what the Indian government's position is, but they're not that keen on breakaways either. But these rows and discussions are still being conducted within the framework created at the end of World War II, and we, you know, that framework needs to be strengthened rather than undermined.
Filton and Bradley Stoke MP, Jack McPresty, asked a question about foreign policy at Prime Minister's Questions this Wednesday, so let's have a listen to him now, Jack McPresty.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. During military operations in Afghanistan, British forces were heavily reliant on locally employed interpreters who constantly put themselves in harm's way alongside our people. I saw my own eyes during Herrick 9 just how brave these interpreters were. Does the Prime Minister agree that it's a stain on our country's honour that we have abandoned a large number of them to be threatened by the Taliban, some have been murdered, others have had to flee their homes in fear of their lives? We owe the interpreters a huge debt of gratitude and honour, and we must provide safety and sanctuary for them here.
Well, what I say to my honourable friend is that we debated and discussed around the National Security Council table in the coalition government and then announced in this House of Commons a scheme to make sure that those people who had helped our forces in terms of translation and other services were given the opportunity of coming to the UK. But we set up two schemes, one to encourage that, but another scheme, a very generous scheme, to try and encourage those people that either wanted to stay or hadn't been translators for a long enough period to stay in Afghanistan and help rebuild that country. And I think that is important to have both schemes in place rather than simply saying that everyone in any way involved can come immediately to the UK. Let's back Afghans to rebuild their own country.
Well, the underlying point about this, of course, is that Helmand province, where the British Army was deployed, is now virtually entirely under the control of the Taliban, as it was always going to end up being, because that's what the local population, however you define these things, ultimately decided they wanted. So all the British boys that lost legs, arms, brains, lives, all for nothing, because the Afghans beat us, as they did in the 1840s and the 1860s. And that's what underlies all of this. Just another failed, miserable, bloodthirsty mess.
UK drone strikes could leave all those involved facing murder charges. This is in The Guardian this week. This is British drone pilots, intelligence officers and ministers could face murder charges if the government does not clarify its positions on targeted killings. That's one of those awful expressions they use for assassinations, isn't it? A parliamentary committee has warned. Confusion over the precise legal justification exposes frontline personnel and all those involved in decisions to launch lethal attacks outside war zones to criminal prosecution for murder or complicity in murder, according to a report by the Joint Committee on Human Rights. Although the Crown Prosecution Service is highly unlikely to pursue such a case in the UK, other nations may do so. For example, if their victims are killed abroad, MPs and peers have cautioned. So, Martin, this is starting to look like that there may be prosecutions if government ministers are involved in these kind of... I mean, it is an assassination. It's not a targeted killing. I mean, what do you mean when you say a targeted killing? Is the opposite of that an untargeted killing? That is just something
well,
random?
Well, the fact of the matter is that a lot of this is pretty untargeted.
So a lot of people die that aren't.
Yeah, a lot of people die. You know, a lot of people a lot of collateral damage. As we said earlier, 80% of casualties in modern warfare are civilians. And I dare say that's true of drone strikes, as it is of anything else.
Some of these drone strikes, of course, have been this hideous idea of a double tap. So one person or one attack, and then as people come to try and rescue them, another Hellfire missile comes down and kills a few dozen people.
Yeah, well, don't forget that a lot of these attacks are being carried out not. You've got no jurisdiction. It's like the Israeli attack on the Hezbollah guy in Damascus. They've got no jurisdiction in Damascus. There's no legal basis for that. None at all. And the same thing's going on when we've been whacking people in Pakistan. But, you know, people sitting back at home in Britain in front of a computer console killing people in Pakistan. The Pakistani elected government of both the left and the right, they've both said to us, don't do this. Don't do this. This is our territory. We will deal with these people in our own way. You have no right to do it. And we've just said, no, we're going to do it anyway. That's illegal. And if it's not legal, it's illegal. And if it's illegal and it's somebody being killed, it's murder. And if you sign the paper, then I think if you were an IRA operative, you could expect 25 years in prison. They should expect 25 years
in prison. This murder warning comes in a report into the government's policies on targeted killing with drones, which was published Tuesday this week. The committee launched its inquiry after David Cameron announced that UK drones had targeted and killed a 21-year-old Briton, Riyad Khan, in Syria last August. The attack took place months before MPs voted for airstrikes in Syria. Another Briton, Ruhul Amin, and a Belgian, Abu Ayman al-Belgiki, who were travelling in the same vehicle, also died in the attack. British-born Junaid Hussein was killed in a separate joint UK-US strike days later. In January, the US military revealed that civilians had been killed in a previous attempt on Hussein's life. The UK would not confirm or deny whether it had been involved.
Well, the fact is, I don't believe when they say they've killed various people. Because what happens is that they say, well, we've killed so-and-so, and then next year they say, well, we've killed him again. You've got to realise that we're being lied to pretty fundamentally here, not least about the fact that our own special forces and intelligence services have been supporting the groups that we claim to be fighting. What we're doing is using these groups. We gen them up, we get them in there. British special forces have been inside Syria, we know that. We get them all going, and then we say, oh, we're going to have to intervene here to stop these terrible people, which means that we can intervene, which is what we really want to do. We want to tell the Syrian government what to do. That's what the British and the French have been doing ever since 1918. They're still trying to do it.
The committee's chairman added, if a police officer killed someone in a street in this country, it's automatically sent to the Independent Police Complaints Commission. If the state takes a life abroad, there must be accountability and there must be scrutiny. No inquest has been held into the deaths of Khan and Amin. Khan's local MP, David Brennan, asked ministers if there should not be a coroner's court case to help establish the legal parameters in such cases. Unless a body is repatriated, a coroner is under no obligation to investigate. In the course of its inquiry, the committee was given access to RAF Waddington in Lincolnshire, from where drones flying over the Middle East are controlled via satellite links. Now, I've been past Waddington, Martin. I mean, it's basically not RAF, it's USAF. It's a US airbase, and in fact, many of the aircraft flying in and out of there, although they're military, have got no insignia on, which again is illegal under international law. If you've got a military aircraft, you've got to say whose it is. You know, you've got to have your RAF roundel or your US sign on the side of it saying this is a military plane and it belongs to this country.
Well, the fact of the matter is that an awful lot of what's been going on is illegal. And it's not just that they've overstepped the mark in a zealous way trying to stop terrorism. My contention is that much of this Islamist terrorism, particularly of the Sunni Salafi variety, is very definitely run by Western intelligence services working with their allies, the Saudi Arabians. And if we're really serious about stopping terrorism, we'd be arresting some of our senior military and intelligence officials and putting them in courts, properly run courts, properly constituted courts. I don't believe in summary justice. And the whole purpose of that is to get to the bottom of it, what really has been going on. And I'm afraid most ordinary people still don't realise how implicated we are in the very terrorism we claim to be fighting.
Well, you say we, but we can be our allies too. And yesterday in The Guardian, it's reported Saudi officials were supporting 9/11 hijackers, so said the one of the members of the Commission of Inquiry in the US. First serious public split revealed amongst commissioners over the release of the secret 28 pages that detail Saudi ties to the 2001 terrorist attacks. Now, this is all coming out largely because of the US presidential elections, Martin, but a former Republican member of the 9/11 Commission, breaking dramatically with the Commission's leaders, said Wednesday he believes that there was clear evidence Saudi government employees were part of a support network for the 9/11 hijackers, and the Obama administration should move quickly to declassify a long secret congressional report on Saudi ties to the 2001 terrorist attack. The comments by John F. Lehman, an investment banker in New York who was Navy Secretary in the Reagan administration, signaled the first serious public split amongst the 10 commissioners since they issued a 2004 final report that was largely read as an exoneration of Saudi Arabia, which was home to 15 of the 19 hijackers on 9/11. But of course, there's 28 pages that still haven't been published, and we know why now.
Well, no, we don't know why. We're getting to what's
well,
happening.
That's because it implicates the Saudis.
Yeah, but don't forget, Tony, that there's quite a lot of evidence that there weren't any hijackers on the day. what's happening now is that the Saudis are being put in the frame to be blamed. In actual fact,
there weren't any hijackers.
No, there's several of the people who said to be the hijackers popped up on BBC and in the Daily Telegraph in the subsequent week saying, actually, I'm still alive and I certainly wasn't a hijacker. None of those hijackers appear on the passenger manifest.
But these
manifests.
Are the people that the... Okay, whether they are or not, these are the people and individuals who the commission have been tracking, and they found that they were actually being helped by the Saudi government, by Saudi intelligence.
That's no doubt the case. But the Saudis are quite possibly in on 9/11, along with Mossad, MI6 and the CIA. Don't forget, three buildings come down here in what looks like controlled demolition. Now, that can't be carried out by 19 Saudi Arabian hijackers. The fact is that we've been lied to fundamentally about everything to do with that attack from the get-go. But then we were lied to about the bombing of Bologna Railway Station in 1980, which subsequent police investigation showed was definitely carried out by NATO intelligence services, including our own joyful MI6. They are the terrorists. Somebody's going to have to do something about it. Serious police officers need to get on the case and start arresting these people. That's the way to put a stop to terrorism. No tolerance, 100% police investigation of everything, including top generals and intelligence officers who run these shows. They've got to pay the price.
Well, some of those top generals have almost, one could say, defected, haven't they? Michael Flynn, for example, General Dempsey.
Well, Dempsey and Flynn have been pushed out because they didn't agree with the Obama administration's line on ISIS. They showed that the West was in fact supporting ISIS. This doesn't really make the mainstream media, does
it? Well, hang on. This is Michael Flynn saying it was a willful decision to create ISIS
in the
first place.
Yes, that's right. A willful decision.
This guy is...
He's the head of the National Security Agency.
No, he's not, Martin. He's not the head of the National Security Agency. He's the head of the Defence Intelligence Agency in the United States. And he was the boss, the general in charge. And he's saying it was a willful decision to create ISIS.
Indeed.
Absolutely unbelievable. So he's been sort of elbowed out. Oh, how embarrassing.
Well, what
we can't have this guy on CNN, but he has been appearing on places like Russia Today, hasn't he?
Indeed, and a lot of this is covered in Seymour Hersh's work, if people are interested in that. He exposed the My Lai massacre back in the 70s. His contacts at the top in US military and intelligence circles are impeccable.
I mean, the thing is...
He pretty much knows what goes on.
The thing is, with Michael Flynn, he was certainly in a position to know. He's the guy who would definitely know about it. Well, who's this Dempsey character then?
Dempsey was a more senior guy than Flynn, but he wasn't happy with the whole policy of supporting ISIS, basically. So what he was doing under the table, according to Hersh, was passing to the Syrians and the Russians through third parties intelligence about ISIS operations so that they could try and fight ISIS more effectively. But what you've actually got now going on in Syria is you've got British US military supporting, for example, the Kurdish militias against the al-Nusra Front, which are being supported by the CIA. But can't you see how wicked all of this is? We're just supporting all these different factions, and the factions are, within Western intelligence are supporting their different protégés. Meanwhile, people have to try and bring up children and look after the elderly in the middle of the chaos we so casually create.
Also, how Britain funds the propaganda war against ISIS in Syria. I was pretty shocked to find this. Is Ian Cobain, Alice Ross, Rob Evans and Mona Mahmoud in The Guardian earlier this month. The British government is waging information warfare in Syria by funding media operations for some of the rebel fighting groups. Well, they can call them rebel fighting groups. I might. And I would call them terrorists, in the foreign front of what David Cameron has called the propaganda war against Islamic State. The campaign, actually, isn't it more a propaganda war against the Syrian government? The campaign aims to boost the reputation of what the government calls the moderate armed opposition, a complex and shifting alliance of armed factions. Deciding which factions to support is risky for the government because many groups have become increasingly extremist as the five-year civil war grinds on. Contractors hired by the Foreign Office, overseen by the Ministry of Defence, produce videos, photos, military reports, radio broadcasts, print products and social media posts branded with the logos of fighting groups and effectively run a press office for opposition fighters.
Well, that's what they... I mean, we know that they do that because we've now got the information. But besides that, they're also providing them with weaponry. And this is the Prime Minister accused Jeremy Corbyn of being a terrorist sympathiser in the House of Commons. The Prime Minister isn't a terrorist sympathiser. He is a terrorist. He supports these people both financially and militarily, who kill children, who kill families. Is he a terrorist? Yes, he is a terrorist. And I'm not a pacifist. At a certain point, what do you do when people carry out things like that? Do you arrest them, or do you plant a bomb under their car? That's where we're going to have to go, isn't it?
Materials are circulated in the Arabic broadcast media and posted online with no indication that it's a British government press release, effectively. As the Guardian's reported, the Home Office Office of Security and Counter-Terrorism is running a parallel effort within the UK, aiming to bring about behavioural and attitudinal change among British Muslims by producing anti-ISIS messaging at an industrial pace and scale. In both the foreign and domestic campaigns, the government's role is concealed. Messages are put out under the banner of apparently independent groups, community organisations in the UK and armed groups in Syria.
So, in other words, we're supposed to have a democratic society where everybody makes up their mind and the government doesn't try and influence things. Meanwhile, they're funding both terrorists and terrorist propagandists with our taxes in order to convince us of a certain kind of perspective on what's going on. And the whole thing stinks, frankly.
The UK's propaganda effort for the Syrian armed opposition began after the government failed to persuade Parliament to support military action against Assad. In autumn 2013, the UK embarked on a behind-the-scenes work to influence the course of the war by shaping perceptions of opposition fighters. I suppose this is what they call soft power or psychological warfare, Martin, through its Conflict and Stability Fund. First time I've ever heard of that. The government is spending £2.4 million on private contractors working from Istanbul to deliver strategic communications and media operations support to the Syrian moderate armed opposition. Now, it's not the first time we've heard about strategic communications on this show, is it? Although this is effectively like public relations for big companies, massive multinationals, but even a step up from that, strategic communications, these people are often trained psychological warfare officers.
Well, it's warfare. Basically, that's what we're talking about, warfare. And I've mentioned this before, Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, was absolutely clear. He was approached when he was a foreign minister by British officials, presumably MI6, saying, we're going to run an armed uprising in Syria. So as things stand, we have on the record evidence that Britain started the war in Syria, in which thousands of people have died. Britain, us, our government. What are we going to do about it?
Meanwhile, Hillary Clinton's emails apparently have been hacked by Russia. Kremlin is deciding whether to release 20,000 stolen emails. This is according to a report from 4 days ago. Beginning in 2011, the Russians began monitoring Romanian computer hacker Marcel Lazar Lehel, a.k.a. Guccifer, after he attempted unsuccessfully to break into the computer system of the Russian RT television network. After monitoring him, the Russians were reportedly able to record both physically and electronically his actions, which allowed the Russian intelligence analysts not only to detect his breaking into the private computer of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, but also break in and copy all of its contents as well. The report notes, shortly after Russia obtained Clinton's emails, they released a limited amount to RT television, which were published in an article in May 2013 entitled Hillary Clinton's Hacked Benghazi Emails.
Yeah, well, I mean, at this stage, we're not clear whether this is true, or it's certainly out there, but it's only one source. Simon Hirsch, who we were talking about earlier, credibility.
The Associated Press reported in October 2015 Hillary's private email server maintained in her home while serving as Secretary of State was hacked by Russian-tied authorities and others on 5 separate occasions. The AP report noted that investigators discovered among Clinton's cache of released emails malicious software aimed at transmitting data to 3 overseas computers, including at least one in Russia. This malware was reportedly activated by clicking on it. But in October, it was not clear if Hillary Clinton had actually made that click.
Indeed. So these are murky waters. I think that there's attacks going on Clinton about these emails. So, you know, it's because of the presidential election, that's all being dragged up in order to try and discredit her. What Simon Hirsch said in an interview last week or the week before was that she signed off and she knew about what was actually going on in Benghazi. They were basically getting Libyan weaponry and obviously Libyan fighters, taking them off to Syria. So they were looting Gaddafi's arsenal and making sure it all ended up in Syria, including sarin, which was taken from Libya to Syria and then used by the al-Nusra Front, one of our proteges, you know, al-Qaeda Syria, to kill innocent civilians in Ghouta with the aim of blaming it on Assad. All of which has been uncovered discovered by Seymour Hersh, who also interviewed Dempsey and Flynn, by the way. His connections are extremely influential.
Now, this leads us on to talk about the Snoopers Charter. We'll be hearing from the investigative journalist Duncan Campbell, he's not the guy that was the crime reporter of The Guardian. He worked in the 1980s, mainly doing series for the BBC, etc., on surveillance. At the time, it was GCHQ, and there was a whole battle going on over whether people were even going to know that GCHQ existed in Cheltenham. This is a question asked at Prime Minister's Questions, though, first, by Gavin Newland on Wednesday.
Gavin Newland!
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. The Prime Minister, as leader of the opposition, said that the UK was fast becoming a surveillance state with powers which would cause concern in the most oppressive regimes, and he promised to sweep the whole rotten edifice away. But he's completely U-turned, and his investigative powers bill proposes to attain a record of every website visited by anyone in the UK. Why has the Prime Minister changed from being the self-proclaimed defender of civil liberties in opposition to championing ineffective mass surveillance in government?
I have to say, I just completely disagree with the Honourable Gentleman. I hope he will follow and listen to the debates that take place on this vital bill. The fact is, if you want to make sure that we can keep our country safe, just as we have been able to see the communications data when two people talk to each other on a mobile phone or a fixed phone, so if that conversation is taking place by people visiting an internet site, is he happy for plots to be hatched, terrorism to be planned, murders to be arranged because people are using an internet site rather than a telephone? Then my answer to that is no. We've got to modernise the capabilities to keep our country safe, and that's what this bill's about.
Well, the rules for this are pretty clear. If you have a reasonable suspicion that somebody is involved in terrorist activity, then you get a warrant from a judge in order to pursue their personal communications. You do not go out and just randomly go on fishing expeditions. It's actually written into the US Constitution. One of the early clauses of the US Constitution said that the government is not empowered to interfere in private communications unless they have a reasonable suspicion that people are involved in criminal activity.
Martin, okay, let's just get a reality check here, because one of the things which we heard from the Edward Snowden revelations, which coincided with the Bilderberg conference, the very first revelations from Snowden when he was in Hong Kong back in 2013, it was that actually there's loads and loads of surveillance going on that none of us knew about. In fact, MPs didn't know about. You've also got journalists, lawyers and MPs themselves all under surveillance.
So in other words, the surveillance state has grown up outside the law. It doesn't have a legal basis. This is why they're bringing a law in to basically ex post facto justify what they're already doing. But of course, as we know from our friend Kevin Cahill, who's been on this show, there's no legal basis for this, and the internet companies which are implicated can be sued in the civil courts, and they are going to be sued in the civil courts. It could bankrupt them. Now, ultimately, we're going to have to move to a society where the state doesn't stick its finger into everybody's business. And of course, if you are a serious terrorist, like some people are out there, or a serious operator, then you know how to evade this surveillance anyway. You don't bother with a lot of this electronic communication because you'd be a damn fool if you did.
I think I don't actually believe this thing that supposedly terrorists plan their actions on social media.
I don't believe it for a minute.
I just think it's
they get together in places where they think there are no bugs and talk in whispers.
Transparently nonsense. It amazes me that anyone thinks that someone would believe that. But anyhow, now let's move on to hear from Duncan Campbell. He was speaking earlier this week to the National Union of Journalists in London, and here are some of his thoughts on this Snoopers Charter, the IP Bill, Investigatory Powers Bill.
Pivotal moment is, I think, of my colleague and friend Bill Goodwin, who courageously stood up for our duty not to be compelled to disclose sources, stood his ground all the way to Strasbourg, and I was just noting on my way up here that in pivotal stuff that has a result of all the social and political changes we're into, this report by the Interception of Communications Commissioner's Office in 2015 into the abuse of previous powers to identify journalistic sources. Bill's name is in pole position, another case backed by the Union. And quite recently, as the bill is going through Parliament, The union's contribution has actually been very important and very strong. It's a bit of a shambles. I've actually tried to help one of the political parties get their stuff in order. The government is just trying to steamroll their stuff through. So you are having all these extraordinary powers come through.
So, but what you're saying, Martin, effectively is that the reason why we've got this is because there's actually criminals at GCHQ and signing off, reading surveillance material, and they don't want to be criminals. They're trying to bring their criminal activity within the law by getting the law changed.
Indeed, and don't forget everything else we've been discussing here. It's my contention that the intelligence services are not just out of control, but are in fact the major source of terrorist activity. And that requires the police to have the investigative powers to investigate that, including bugging their phones. Why not? Their phones, not our phones.
Now, one of the ways that Duncan Campbell started in this journey of investigative journalism into surveillance in Britain, the kind of Big Brother state, back in the 1980s, was his looking at GCHQ, yes, but also, of course, the first revelations of what RAF, again, another RAF station that's really a USAF, American airbase. It was an airbase, anyway, it's now a surveillance station at Menwith Hill in Yorkshire. What's your understanding of how this all works, Martin? Because certainly one of the things I've seen is through something called the Yakuza Agreement, the Americans would spy all over Britain and the British would spy all over America for each other. So they could say, oh, well, we're not breaking the law in our own country. So the Americans would be breaking the law in Britain, but they'd be doing it from America. So the Americans, if they wanted to spy on someone illegally, would ask the British to do it, and the British vice versa.
Well, those, it seems rather quaint now having, we've had the Snowden revelations. The new technology, as the Prime Minister pointed out, allows, virtually 100% surveillance of everybody. And the temptation for the securocrats to go for that is overwhelming. And in actual fact, that's what they've been doing. They've been surveying everybody, and then you're using computer analysis to try and assess what they've been finding.
One of the things that I would say as a journalist, doing work on all this kind of thing, is I've noticed, as soon as you start putting up kind of security things like firewalls, you find all sorts of bugs and problems and your computer doesn't work. What seems to work best is if you just have a computer with absolutely nothing on it, then, which obviously the National Security Agency, everyone else can kind of go into your computer, see what everything that's going on in there, then you get left alone. It's almost like you get left alone and there's no problems with it. I mean, that's my experience. I don't know what yours is, Martin.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. And I think there's not much point being paranoid about being snooped on. We are being snooped on, but there's no legal basis for it. Yeah, just like there's no legal
Duncan
basis for drone strikes. And that's going to cost them in the end.
What
things that are not legal, you can be sued for.
What Duncan's talking about there was this whole idea of protection of sources, because that's important. If you get someone as a whistleblower coming to you as a journalist, the last thing you want is for them to be clamped in irons, say, by the by military police, by the security services, or even possibly by foreign security forces.
Well, in the past, the rules were that you could only spy on people if you were involved in spying, as it were, which involves, foreign diplomats and whatever. There's supposedly some rules for that, but they weren't the same as for ordinary people. But the police, in particular, were not allowed to go on fishing expeditions. Explicitly forbidden. Fishing expeditions, no. You've got to have reasonable suspicion before you can interfere with other people's communications. That's all gone by the board, because the new technology has just been so easy for them to just say, well, we don't need to bother with that
well,
anymore.
Well, funnily enough,
we can look at everything, why don't we?
Funnily enough, there was a fishing expedition into the Chief Constable, Nick Gargan, wasn't there, a couple of years ago, which eventually led to him losing his job. So fishing expeditions, you're absolutely right. These sorts of things should be stopped. But anyway, as part of the talk he gave, Duncan Campbell also was talking a little bit about how the BT telephone network was originally set up almost to be a kind of surveillance network rather than a communication network for the public. So a bit of a cheek that we even have to pay for it, really. So anyway, here he is talking about that now.
British Telecom were long ago compromised. They're completely built into all the intelligence systems. I could go back to a story I wrote in 1984. They had a secret division called IP5, which was running the telephone tapping, another R12, which was doing all the research and bugging. So a British Telecom began as the Post Office Telephones Division. It was integrated into the surveillance system. It has its own GCHQ code name, its Remedy. It assists GCHQ to tap into other people's cables. So... the idea that anything that started life in BT could get any more corrupt and open to abuse as a surveillance tool is, excuse me while I fall about laughing.
Interesting, isn't it? I mean, he seems to be sort of going along with this idea, Martin, that a lot of this stuff is much more open to surveillance than we've previously known.
Yes, and I think any if you were trying to organise a resistance movement anywhere in the world, let's just put it that way.
What about a legitimate political movement? Maybe, for example, an NGO which is campaigning against, say, an oil company that's got some weight and power that can sort of twist the arm of the intelligence services to just snoop on you for them. Or also, of course, then there's private agents as well.
Yes, there are, and I'm afraid that's the world we're in. There's not a lot of point if you're involved in legitimate political activity worrying about being surveyed. You should be more worried about being infiltrated and having your funds messed with, somebody stealing your money or just starting arguments in your committee or whatever. That's more worrying than being surveyed. If you were organising, some kind of armed resistance, and of course in some parts of the world that is unfortunately a necessary thing, then my advice would be to follow the advice of the Iraqi resistors, which is throw your mobile phones away and just rely on talking to people.
Now, also on to this story about the petrodollar. Well, from golden dollar to petrodollar to narco dollar, the slide of the dollar, Martin. Fantastic article you sent me during the week by William Engdahl. The role as world reserve currency is something no financial hegemon in history has willingly surrendered. So are the Americans ever going to surrender this? And how has it come from a gold-backed currency which the whole world relied on all the way down to now it's basically a cocaine-backed currency?
Well, it happened in stages. At the end of World War II, the US held most of the world's gold supply.
Okay, let's just say June 44, Bretton Woods Conference. This is when you're talking about, yeah?
Yep. That's right. And they gathered together the great and the good of the world, including our own J.M. Keynes, and they agreed a system for running the world's finances, which would, I mean, what Keynes wanted was an independent international currency called Bancor, which would be backed by gold. But the Americans weren't having that. They were saying, no, we're going to have the dollar as the world impact, but it's going to be backed by gold. And in theory, the the dollar was exchangeable into gold, which gave it a stability. The system actually functioned reasonably well for quite a long time. So it wasn't a gold standard system, because the dollar could be expanded. It wasn't tied one-to-one to gold. So, you know, at times of when you wanted to expand the money supply, you could, in a discretionary way, but always within limits, because the gold, there was always a gold standard in the background. But, of course, they were losing the war in Vietnam, and they wanted to carry on fighting, but they didn't want to raise taxes on the rich. So what they did is they took the dollar off gold. And by doing that, of course, they then created the dollar system. And then, of course, subsequent to that, you then had the OPEC price rise, which was actually engineered with the Americans. Don't forget, the Saudis and the Americans, wink, wink, top buddies, were going to rise the oil price. And that absolutely smashed, of course, developing countries who had to buy all their oil in dollars. The Saudis have agreed that they will only sell oil in dollars. And their dominance of the oil market means that everybody has to have dollars in order to buy oil. But, of course, that's now crumbling because of the policy of having a low oil price in order to mess up the Russians, the Iranians, the Venezuelans. So what's now happened, and this is where the Panama Papers come in, there are various other tax havens around the world, like Panama, etc., where you could stick your money. They are being targeted by these targeted leaks. And guess what? The United States is now opening up for business, Reno in Nevada and other places, where you really can put your money and nobody will find out what you're up to. So, and that's a way of keeping the dollar as the world's reserve currency, which of course is a primary goal of the oligarchy that runs the United States of America.
So what was this anti-corruption conference this week all about then?
Window dressing, frankly. It's absurd, really, for the British to say that, even in the official tables, we're quite a way down. We're not regarded as an entirely reputable country. But of course, the real delusion in all of that is that when we say the Saudi Arabia is a very corrupt country, or Afghanistan is a very corrupt country, Afghanistan and Nigeria, as Cameron was supposed to say, oh, they're terribly, terribly corrupt. Guess who corrupts those people? It would be our businessmen and weapons sellers who go there and corrupt them. And they're totally corrupt because we corrupted them. The City of London is the centre of global corruption. So that's why we're having a corruption conference.
And also, it's a fig leaf. On the same day, Brazil's President Dilma Rousseff is impeached, removed from power. She has to walk out of the presidential palace.
Well, what she's been accused of is not personal corruption at all. Everybody agrees that personally she's above reproach. She was in fact electrocuted and raped by the military government in the 60s. But what she did do, supposedly, is she lied about the national debt to try and get re-elected. She did the sort of thing that George Osborne does, trying to pretend that the deficit's coming down when it isn't.
So is this just the CIA?
It is, basically. Yes. It is. It's a manoeuvre by the oligarchy in the US to get rid of all the left-wing governments in Latin America who've been a thorn in their flesh over the last decade or so.
Well, I've booked my tickets to Bilderberg in 4 weeks' time, so I guess I'll be reporting on this show from Dresden. Hope I will, anyway. Martin, we've just heard this week that the Bilderberg Conference, which is, just to give you a bit of background, is basically a kind of big business and bankster lobby in the NATO countries and of NATO and of all the politicians in NATO. We often find that people who visit the Bilderberg Conference then rise to power magically after going there. We've got the top apex, the apex of the German... I mean, I've never seen anything like this, Martin. All of the key people, the top six ministers in the whole of the German government are all going. Maybe you'll get one at a Bilderberg Conference, but never all six, and it's all happening in Dresden.
Well, presumably they are thinking about what they're going to do about the looming war with Russia, potential Greek meltdown, Brexit, and goodness knows what's happening with the Chinese and the South China Sea.
The Bilderbergs have been proven to have been a large force behind the creation of the EU, and I think they may well be worried that Britain will be exiting EU 2 weeks after their conference.
Well, I think they'll have much more on their plate than Britain's little squabble. The real problem is that the Germans
will be happy for Britain to leave then?
Oh, they're probably not, but their real problem is their industry is being wiped out by sanctions on Russia.
I mean, can they blame us after the currency crisis, the migrant crisis? Brussels has just completely failed to deal with
this. Well, listen, Bilderberg works on a much higher level than the EU. The EU is a vehicle for the Bilderbergers. NATO is the level that Bilderberg operates on. War and peace. War and peace, that's what they talk about, and money.
Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7 o'clock. Up next, Makawi and Kamal's Arabian Nights. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, MP for Bristol West, Thangam Debonair. thisweek.org.uk takes you straight to this show's links and archive. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Do join us for the politics show at 5 next week. Don't let the banksters get you down.
On the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.